Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Politics Out the Boring Pits, live on your wireless, 3 hours a day. It's lovely. Right, coming up on today's episode, as well, the migrant crisis is really taking hold. Not the one crossing the channel, important though that is, but the one that's playing out outside North Africa and then heading into Italy. The situation is really serious there. In fact, Emmanuel Macron's just sent one of his ministers to Italy to try and intervene. So we're going to take a bigger picture look at migration around the world. How is it playing out in North Africa, in Italy, France, Germany too, but also going to America and Australia to see how they're dealing with what's likely to be an increasing number of people moving around the world. So that's our big thing in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at what's going on in the world with today's columnist panel.
The Columnists on Times Radio.
And join us everyone on Tuesday by Danny Finkstein. Hello, Danny.
Hello.
Nice to see you. And in the studio for the first time?
Second time.
Jane Merrick, policy editor of the I. How are you?
Morning, very well, thanks.
We're going to talk about your saving of trees.
Great.
Shortly. But first, Danny, you've been trying to save the centre right. You've written, you've contributed to a book called The Case for the Centre Right, edited by David Gork. What is the case for the centre-right?
Well, I really enjoyed doing this essay. David asked it to me, and I originally agreed rather reluctantly, but because I have respect for him, for his courage and his intelligence, and I like him, I said yes, and then spent a lot of time trying to work out what I wanted to say. So the essay is an attempt to suggest what the difference is between the centre-right and the centre-left. To do that, I had to try and define the centre. Well, we've only got half an hour, so I'm not going to go into the whole argument. But in essence, it argues that every political issue has got a case in favour of it and a case against it. Real arguments in favour of it and against it. In the centre, you come to terms with the fact that that's the case, and you try to then deal with the resulting issue by using a sense of proportion. But a sense of proportion is subjective, and that means there will be a difference between the centre-right and the centre-left. The other thing, however, that dropped out of it for me is that all of our political rows are between, you know, the centre-right and the centre-left on tax or on benefits. They're really important, big, big issues. But when I was writing my book on my family and the dictators, which you and I have talked about before, it made it less easy for me to be as invested as I was before in the arguments I'm having with Yvette Cooper. I realised that there are an awful lot of arguments now that separate the centre taken together with people that are not in the centre. In other words, who see politics not as pluralistic, who think there are basically right and wrong answers to everything rather than trying to deal with things by a sense of proportion, and who think there's a spirit of the nation which they embody as a political movement or as an individual. And so I found that really interesting. People will see whether they think I've been successful. Obviously, you can see by the cast of characters in it, Gavin Barwell, Theresa May's former assistant, Amber Rudd, Rory Stewart, Michael Heseltine, quite a lot of those, Andrew Cooper, quite a lot of those people aren't in the Conservative Party, and it demonstrates how far away those arguments are from being you know, successful in the Conservative Party. On the other hand, I think Dan Hannan argued correctly the other day in the Telegraph, actually, Rishi Sunak belongs at one edge of the centre-right. Definitely, his politics are, in certain respects, more right-wing than mine, but we definitely speak the same language. So I would argue to those people who wrote in this book but are not in the Conservative Party that that's still a tenable position.
What do you make of it, Jade? It's a really interesting point that Danny makes, that the centre has become a sort of thing on its own in battle with the extremes on the two. You know, we saw with Jeremy Corbyn on the left and then certain elements in the Tory party right now. And so it's been defined by those things instead.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we had sort of years of Blair in the centre and then Cameron in the centre and then obviously Brexit happened and populism. I mean, it's interesting that the next election will have two quite centrist leaders in Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak. And how much is Rishi Sunak going to be urged by the right of his party to actually be sort of more right-wing, off the centre? Is that actually going to... He's not going to win any more votes, but he's going to take more defensive position and be kind of more right-wing on crime, on immigration. And it's interesting, actually, what I read the Dan Hannan review of the book. He's actually welcoming David Gawke and saying he needs to be back in the Conservative Party. We need to have people like this back in the Conservative Party. And where is the Conservative Party going to go after 2024? If Rishi Sunak leaves, are they going to have a kind of a reassessment of where the party wants to be for the next 10 years? Are they going to be out of power for 4 years or 20 years? Yeah. You know, where is the future of the party? And it's really interesting that I think this book is kind of setting down a marker and saying that we can't just have a sort of a debate about Remain or leave anymore. It has to be about the future of the party and the future of the centre.
It's interesting, though, that your point about how they're both pretty centrist, actually it means that they end up overemphasising the point that Danny was making, you know, exaggerating differences that, you know, stop the boats versus crash the gangs, or, you know, they're essentially all in the same place. There's not, but they have to exaggerate then the minor differences.
Yeah, and I think that's been Keir Starmer's problem in focus groups. You know, people have said they don't really know what he stands for, they don't really know what it's for. And I think we may come on to talk about this, but the kind of what Labour is doing, what Starmer is doing, is maybe a more muscular approach to policy that they need to do to get that definition against Sunak at the next election.
His position, it does seem to be, this country's completely broken, let's do nothing about it. and I can see why you can question that, right? You say he should have more vision, but I think as an electoral strategy, this kind of reassurance is probably correct. And, you know, that's why all the conversations we have about the problems that Keir Starmer is having, he's 15 points ahead in the polls, so he isn't having a big political problem. What, you know, some people may argue that he'll have a problem dealing with these issues when he gets into power, but my view is he's better off having serious practical solutions to actual issues rather than big, vague visions, which actually don't in fact mean anything when they correspond to the real world. The question is whether those solutions are credible. So, for example, I feel the position he's taken, in which he's suggesting that without joining the single market or rejoining the EU, he's going to reopen our negotiations with the European Union and do better in meeting his unmeetable terms from before the May's Brexit deal. I find that completely incredible. So he has to come up with credible answers.
It's interesting, Jane, that he doesn't have a problem because he's 15, 20 points ahead of the polls, but he just seems to be creating his own problems. So last week, a very hard-line stance on the migrant boats, and everyone sort of picked holes in that and said, well, actually, you're going to end up with more people coming in. Then he said he wants to reopen the Brexit deal. He's also been talking about votes at 16. He's sort of painting more and more targets on his own back.
But I would actually disagree with that. I think the opposite is true. I think that actually 15, 20 points isn't that big if you think about he hasn't really sealed the deal with the electorate. He hasn't really got anything, hasn't had much to say to voters. So he has to be he has to be saying more things. I mean, at least he's saying something about Brexit now.
And actually,
he spent
four,
3 years not talking about Brexit. It's ridiculous.
If the criticism was, I don't know what he stands for, at least there's a row about something he said. People get a sense that he stands for something.
And don't forget, he's not just got to win back Red Wall voters who don't want Brexit undone, and he's not going to undo Brexit, but he wants to improve the trade deal. He's got to win back in Scotland. You know, that's a very Remain-y part. He's got to reassure his sort of core, I guess, metropolitan voters that he's not going to do anything mad and sort of, you know, be too you know, be like the Tories. So he's got to appeal to this broader base. And I don't think that 15 to 20 point lead is that safe. So he's just got to be a bit more noticeable. And I think that carrying the Ming vase strategy wasn't working. Maybe this is a thing under Sue Gray. Maybe she's sort of introducing this more.
No, so I think it was working. Approach. And I, you know, that's, you know, so I think it was the correct strategy for him. But I, you know, but I think from the electorate's point of view, it's better to gain a slightly clearer view. So from a Democratic yeah. point of view, I'm glad if he decides to move there. I wouldn't advise him to do it if I was... I think the strategy he was embarked upon was palpably working politically for him. But I think it's, you know, but it's good if we learn something more about him. I do think this issue of the European Union is a dilemma for him. If you are the Conservatives and you can see that... you know, you want to move away from the European social model anyway. It's not credible to go into the single market. This is the issue may be difficult because of its consequences, but it's settled. For Labour, he could end up in a situation where he's moving towards the European social model. Everybody's arguing with him. The only solution is therefore to be part of the single market. And even he thinks that's the correct solution. And when you're the Prime Minister, you think it's the correct solution. You think you can make it work with your base. What do you do then? Are you really going to hold out from it? So I think ultimately this is going to be, it'll be a difficult issue.
Particularly not, you know, if Boris Johnson won on get Brexit done, can you win on a slogan of let's reopen Brexit a little bit?
And the risk is, actually, I mean, obviously Rishi Sunak has taken a more pragmatic approach yeah. to Brussels, so there is not much difference. There is a slight nuance difference. But you're right, and the risk is for Keir Starmer is that it will allow newspapers who are opposed to him, the Conservative Party and others, to basically say Brexit is not safe under Keir Starmer. Yeah. And that is such a more, that's a more striking, memorable phrase than... we need to just do this, we need to do that.
But even if you look at the Remainers who voted for Boris Johnson in 2019, you know, the get Brexit done was worked because Leavers were like, yes, I want it sorted.
Yes.
The whole bunch of Remainers who were just like, yes, just stop talking about it. I want this chaos to be over and I want you to concert, you know, we voted Leave, I think we should leave, let's just get it done. And if you start, you don't necessarily win back the Remain vote if you start saying you're going to start tinkering with it.
I think the question is whether by the next election, whether in, you know, the economic debate's been dominated by inflation and interest rates yeah. and cost of living. If that debate is sort of quietened down a bit, it will allow basically people to think, well, are we better off under Brexit? Could we be doing trade rules a little bit better? And that will then become more of a potent issue.
Yeah. It is weird, actually, Danny. If you look at, you know, the polls overwhelmingly show people think Brexit was the wrong thing to have done. They think it's gone badly. They think it's harmed the economy. I think even in some polls, people said they would now vote to remain. And you've got the leader of two major parties, three, well, if you count the SNP, Labour, Lib Dems and SNP, all think it was a bad thing to do and they wish we were still in the EU. And no one will say it, with the exception of the SNP, actually.
Yeah.
The Lib Dems don't want to talk about it. And you've got, like you said, you could end up with a Labour Prime Minister who thinks we should be in the EU but won't say it.
But the problem is that I think they correctly judged that rejoining the European Union would threaten the country would threaten potential voters with a lot of chaos, and they don't want that. It would probably mean having to promise another referendum. I don't know, it would be a very unpopular promise. And anything short of that is goes back to the issues we debated forever. Do you join the single market and become a rule taker rather than a rule maker? Is exactly the issue we got into before. And, you know, we talked about slogans. Lots of them were meaningless. I came up with one for a conference which was Opportunity for All, and would have been fine if it had been linked to a strategy that really meant that, but it wasn't. But Brexit, get Brexit done was a strategy linked to a policy. You can argue about whether it got it done on the wrong party, on the wrong basis and all that, but it was linked to a policy. So, and I think it was quite popular. So getting Brexit undone, I don't think is a very good, I don't think that's a very good slogan. And I don't think it's, I think he doesn't need a policy to persuade, you know, Remainers in London to vote Labour, because he's got the Tories to do that.
I suppose that's a good point. And actually sort of raising their hope, the risk of saying you're going to do something is probably greater than just not talking about it and moving on. So on the Labour Party slogan then, give Britain its future back.
Can I have my ball back, please? It's a bit like that, isn't it?
But it is a bit, give it back feels a bit, it's not taking back control.
Yes.
Give it back.
I'm not sure about the passive voice in the
Well, somebody actually emailed in and said they thought that giving what do they say? Giving you your future back was sort of better, because it's sort of give it back sounds like a like you're telling someone off.
Yes.
Rather than giving you something.
I think it's really, really hard to come up with something that's broad gauge and meaningful. So get Brexit done, really sacrifice lots of other policy areas, right? Yeah. It wasn't saying let's get climate change done, or it was let's get Brexit done. So if you used to do something on the future, it's hard. And if you're going to do that, I don't think that's too bad. I mean, truthfully, I don't think anybody's going to pay the slightest bit of attention to it. That's the truth of it. This conversation we have is like going to be the high point. So I don't think, you know, we need to worry about it too much. But it's not a bad idea that people feel that Britain was on a path and it's been, you know, that's been denied to them. I can see why it appeals to a certain type of feeling. Actually, I'm not sure that it's a feeling that's shared by all Labour voters. So it is quite a Remainer slogan, right? It is aimed at people who say that my son and daughter wanted to work, wanted to have European passports.
It's a bit Erasmus.
So it is a bit, it is, I would say it's quite a Remainer orientated slogan when he wants to build a broader voting base.
That's a good point, that.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
But it does mean something.
I mean, people, yeah, exactly. People always want to talk about the future and be the future. And I guess, yeah, he's offering an alternative future. I mean, what I think one of the most memorable party election broadcasts for me was a Pete Postlethwaite in the taxi cab in 1997. And it was an alternative future where the Conservatives had stayed in power and, you know, And it was so powerful because it was basically, you know, you didn't get out, you didn't vote Labour, and basically the future is gone. And I think he's trying to kind of evoke that in this slogan, but maybe something sharper for the election, because
it's a tiny bit long.
It is.
But
long.
They are getting there. And the problem with these slogans, and Danny, you must when you were trying to come up with these, you need to come up with something which A, means something, hasn't been used before normally by the Nazis. You know, this is brilliant. Then I'll have a quick go, it seems to have been used by the Nazis or some far-right, you know, party somewhere, because they've all been through exactly the same problem. So you just end up with a sort of inoffensive word salad. So on that basis, the fact that this means something.
It does, but it's quite niche in its appeal, I think, actually, the more I think about it. So I'm a bit surprised they've chosen it. It's definitely an emotion. It might have come out of a focus group, but it's an emotion that you know, I strongly suspect it has, actually, a bit like we're all in it together, right? Which was a really good slogan, by the way, and a really good, but it came out of a focus group. But I think it's a focus group of a particular type of person that thinks that they've been robbed of the future by what the Tories have done. I mean, obviously, it's ridiculous because there'll be a future because we're going to wake up tomorrow and tomorrow will be the future. But it's implying a certain type of future that we were expecting. And what does that really mean, other than we left the European Union?
Isn't it also slightly misleading because Keir Starmer, Rachel Reeves, Wes Streeting have all said they're not going to be able to wave a magic wand on day one and suddenly, you know, hospitals will have loads of beds available and they'll be able to turn around schools and everything else. So it is slightly misleading that, you know, they need to be a bit more honest, but nobody really wants,
salty porridge. They're not actually promised to give you anything.
Yes.
I was just looking back at some previous ones. David Cameron had Ready for Change. I think that was before.
That's quite good.
Which is quite good. Because it's just a
bit of dynamism.
Yeah, in dynamism. And then in government, they had security, stability, opportunity. That's just a word salad on a whiteboard, and everyone's like, fine, we'll just do that one. Can either of you remember what was behind Theresa May when it fell off the wall?
Opportunity.
You said
it before.
No, that was a different. That was a different
cheating,
one.
And I still failed.
That was a different one, which is just an opportunity. Can you remember the letters that fell off?
Oh, no.
Was there something for all?
No. I mean, it's a sort of right area.
Yeah.
Building a country that works for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Because a big announcement was going to be on housing. And no one remembered.
So it's interesting that, because I, you know, did for all. The Conservatives are often trying to put that for all element in it. Now, unfortunately, it's not necessarily linked to the correct strategy. But the interesting thing about those words is it's trying to counter your impression,
your
right?
Negative.
So it's saying something negative, saying something different. And I'm not sure that Labour's slogan did that.
Yeah.
So I wonder about that slogan, actually, the more I think about it.
Now, Jane, you know, never mind leaving it all to the politicians. Sometimes you have to take back control yourself. and you've saved a tree.
Yeah, this is kind of by accident. So every early morning I take a walk around my neighbourhood to get the body going. And I normally do a route. And last Thursday, for some reason, I went on a completely different route.
Yeah.
Up a local road near mine. Dog Kennel Hill. It's a very busy road in East Dulwich. And I noticed on the beautiful row of London plane trees, and one of the trees had this sign on it that said, "This tree is dead and it will be felled, you know, 19th of September, next Tuesday." And I looked at it and I just thought it was sun was shining, blue sky, beautiful green leaves, really healthy tree. I mean, I'm not a complete expert, but I do take an interest in trees. And it looked healthy. So I took photos and I tweeted at Southwark Council, "Are you sure this tree is really dead?" And then I emailed the council. I was emailing opposition. I emailed the Woodland Trust. I put it on my allotment WhatsApp group, just to sort of, you know, is this tree really dead, or is it, you know, what's the problem? And the council kind of gave me a reply on Twitter saying, "Well, it isn't dead. We're sorry about that, but it is diseased, so it'll still have to be felled." And I kind of gave up over the weekend. I thought, well, you know, 48 hours left. And then yesterday, someone on my allotment had emailed someone else at the council, and they'd got a reply to say, "It's not going to be felled on Tuesday, stay of execution. And there's a little bit of disease that they have to remove in the branches."
Which we understand. Because, so producer Lewis, who works on the show, lives behind the tree.
Amazing.
And so in a statement, producer Lewis said, "Honestly, so many people would see me naked the whole time if it wasn't for that tree. Jane has performed a very important community service here." but then there was a slight panic this morning because there's been, Lewis has been sent exclusive footage of some people with a chainsaw.
Yeah, tree fellers.
But they're just tidying it up.
I think they're removing some of the branches that look like disease. They could be diseased to make it safe.
Danny, have you ever done anything this useful?
No. Jim, this is one of those moments where I was hoping you'd forget that I was actually in the studio. I really genuinely have absolutely nothing of value to add to a discussion about plane trees. Yes, I think drawing broader, it is pretty interesting that it got sort of condemned without anybody taking a very careful look at it. And it probably does suggest where you've done something very good is most of us would look at that, even if we knew something about trees, and think, "I bet they knew something that I didn't know," and you'd leave the tree. And what was impressive is that you thought, "No, actually, I know better than the person who's put this sign up, and I'm going to question it." And it does suggest that we had that. It's a bit like that second opinion law that the Times has been running stories on. That's what you've done for the tree, really.
Yeah, I was really surprised because often with the council, you don't really expect anything to change. So it's sort of, you know, a result that I didn't expect. But actually, just, you know, it's true what Danny is suggesting, that I think a lot of councils probably just kind of go through the motions well, it's, you know, a bit of disease, and let's just fell it.
A little bit of challenge, and you've won. Danny Finkelstein and Jane Merrick from The Eye. Of course, you can read Danny in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/times or Redbox. Up next, it's migration around the world.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, we're off around the world today. We might think that everything happening in Britain is unique and uniquely important. So all the attention here is on the number of people crossing the channel to get here in small boats. But where are they coming from? Where have they been? And in a time when rising temperatures, widening inequality and increasing political instability means there'll be even more movement around the world, how are other countries dealing with this problem? So yes, it's time to climb aboard Chorley Airlines once more. Put your seats in the upright position. Pack away your stow your tables away. Put your bags in the roof above you. I really need to go on a refreshing course. Yes, we're off on Chorley Airlines again to head first to the country that many people are coming to the UK from, France. We're heading to France. Charles Berman is in Paris, where he says the immigration is a hot potato issue there.
The interior minister's gone off to Italy. Macron sent him off short notice to deal with the latest flow of migrants coming into Italy. Try to mend fences with Italy. France and Italy have been loggerheads because France, in Italy's view, is not taking enough of the illegals who are coming in into Lampedusa and the south of Italy. A lot of them are coming over the Alps illegally, and France is upset over that and is squabbling with Italy over the immigration. Yeah.
So Charles Berman in Paris. Well, let's follow the French interior minister off to Italy. He's back on the plane. And we land in Italy, where Giorgia Meloni's welcomed the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen to the Italian island of Lampedusa, where they visited a migrant reception centre. The Italian president said the country is being placed under unsustainable pressure. Here is Giorgia Meloni speaking yesterday.
If somebody here in Europe were to think that this global crisis that we are tackling and facing could be just solved within the Italian borders, within the Italian borders, then it would be a very big and huge mistake on their side, because this massive flow of immigrants is something which requires the involvement and the responsibility by everybody to be tackled.
That was a translation of Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister. Let's speak to Hannah Roberts, who's a journalist in Rome. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, good morning.
Give a sense of the scale, the numbers of people arriving in Lampedusa in recent days.
Yeah, well, migrants arriving by boat in Italy have doubled this year over the same period of last year, which is quite awkward for Giorgia Meloni, who came to power a year ago saying that she was going to solve migration. And last week, over 10,000 people arrived just on the tiny island of Lampedusa, which is right very near Tunisia, about 100 kilometres off the coast, so easier to get to for these small boats. And it created very difficult conditions on the island. People have been fighting over water and shortages of food. Eventually, the government has moved many of them off onto the mainland, but it, as you can imagine, it takes time to get there and pick people up.
I mean, Giorgia Meloni, like you said, had taken quite a hard line on this, but it doesn't seem to be making any difference on the ground.
Well, until now, she's kept pretty quiet. She's been at pains to portray herself as very mainstream since becoming Prime Minister. She wants to be seen as more of a UK-type Tory, even though her party has very fascist roots and nationalist jargon. But in the last few days, this crisis has enabled her to take a very hard line. And so the government yesterday passed measures to increase the detention time for migrants up to 18 months. And the defence minister has been ordered to build new detention centres to house all these migrants. Her emphasis is saying that everybody who doesn't have the right to asylum must be repatriated. And she's managed to get Ursula von der Leyen, who, as you said, visited Lampedusa on Sunday with her, to warm up to the idea of a European naval mission that would block the boats leaving Libya. So this used to be considered an unthinkable, ultra-hard right idea. The fact that the president of the European Commission said she's going to explore this is a huge change.
I mean, the conversation we're having is so similar to the one that's being played out in the UK. Can we stop the boats from coming? Can we send them back? What's the role of the Navy in that? Is it clear that there is a plan that might work? Because, you know, 8,000 arriving in 3 days. I mean, when we're talking about sort of 30, 40,000 arriving in a year in the UK, the scale is so much greater. Is it about trying to sort out the problems in North Africa?
Well, Meloni's been warning that tens of millions of people might come, given the new crisis in Africa, the shortage of grain, natural disasters, environmental issues. So, I mean, she's trying to stoke fears. Whether we're really going to see these kind of numbers is highly unlikely. But a European naval mission to stop people leaving Libya and Tunisia would be very questionable. It would certainly be open to legal challenge from human rights organisations. I think they're already working on it. So whether it's realisable is doubtful.
Well, we'll see how that plans out in Italy. Thank you for that. Hannah Roberts there, journalist in Rome, updated on the situation in Italy. Right, where do they go then, having arrived into Europe? Let's hop back on the plane. A short two-hour flight to Berlin, where Germany's decided to keep taking in migrants and refugees arriving in Italy. Just 2 days after it announced the suspension of a voluntary agreement with Rome to receive new arrivals. This is the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz.
To deal with these challenges, we also need to deepen our relations with other regions of the world, especially with Asia and Africa, from where I just returned. We need to work with them jointly as partners, and we need to become a more geopolitical European Union.
So that was Olaf Scholz speaking there. Let's speak to Elizabeth Findl, a Wall Street Journal reporter based in Berlin. Elizabeth, just take us through some of the history of this, because Angela Merkel received great plaudits when she opened up Germany's borders to welcome refugees back in 2015. What impact did that have on Germany and German politics and their attitudes now?
Yeah, absolutely. 2015, Germany put out this extremely welcoming message of we can handle the migrants. They're welcome here. Large numbers of people have been settling here ever since, particularly from Syria, now many from Afghanistan, from North Africa. And it is this it's this huge huge sea change that never really ended. And so Germany now is certainly the largest destination in Europe for migrants. It is last year, more than 322,000 migrants requested asylum there, which is second only to the US. And that's about half of the United States asylum requests, even though Germany, of course, has less than 4% the landmass of the states and a quarter of the population. And at this point, it's been 8 years. It's been going on long enough that there's a sense within the country that people are starting to get tired of it and feeling like they can't continue to handle settling people. Of course, not everyone feels that way, but there are indications in polls that support for migrants is slipping.
And I was going to say that, what impact is it having on politics? Is there a point at which, and I remember, you know, hearing Angela Merkel speaking before about, in part because she grew up with the Berlin Wall and that sort of sense of separation and borders. That was why she was so, you know, felt almost allergic to borders. Do Germans still feel like that? Do they feel like they can take an unlimited number? Is there a benefit in terms of employment and the economy and so on, although actually the latest economic figures in Germany might suggest otherwise. Do people think it is a good thing for Germany to be doing this, or at some point will they say, like other countries, enough is enough?
I think that's the question. There certainly still is support among many people for taking in refugees, but that is starting to slip. A poll earlier this year by Ipsos found that 48% of Germans now believe the country should stop accepting refugees completely, at least for a while. That number is up from 32% last year, so a pretty significant change over the course of a year. You've seen individual cities push back, saying they're full, they don't have the housing, they don't have resources. But then, of course, you also have had other cities say, we want migrants. You mentioned the economic component, which is really interesting, because Germans have felt that they need foreign workers to fill a lot of jobs, to sort of fix some of the demographic problems. And that has had support, and it's up, 10, 20 years ago, less than a third of Germans thought it was good for the economy to have migrants come. Now it's more like half. But experts have told me there's a bit of a paradox. On one hand, people generally agree that they want and need foreigners to come in and work some jobs, but they consider a certain type of assimilation, especially being fluent in German, more important than other countries. That's difficult. And a lot of people don't see refugees as the answer to the work problem. They complain that migrants don't work, even though the country makes it very, very difficult for those people to work. In many cases.
And I suppose that's an important distinction you're making there. There's a difference between economic migrants who might go to Germany because they can speak German and they want to work, refugees that Germany might take directly from, for instance, Syria, and people who arrive into Europe illegally on small boats, travelling from North Africa and then spread out across Europe and then find themselves in Germany, possibly having got there illegally. And what you do about them, and those I suppose are, it is possible for the electorate to think that economic migrants are a good thing while also questioning a flow of illegal migration. Really interesting that. Thank you for that. That's Elizabeth Findell, a Wall Street Journal reporter based in Berlin. So we've toured Europe, but we leave Germany behind us now. It's back on the plane for 2.5 hours. I'm not sure this is the most direct route we've taken from London to Rome to Berlin. Now we land in Tunis, and Elidzia Volkman is a journalist covering North Africa and migration based in Tunisia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. So a lot of the focus of why, from the sort of British perspective, people are arriving into Europe, but they're coming from North Africa. What's driving it? What are the forces which mean that people take huge risks of their lives to leave North Africa to try to reach Europe?
Well, North Africa is a departure point. So there's a mixture of migration of Tunisians, which has actually been going down. It's down by about 20%. But what's been rising and at times surging has been migration of people from sub-Saharan countries. And there's a lot of different reasons. There's some very strong push factors because of what's been happening in Africa. We've seen major coup d'etats and political violence rising up in places like Mali, Burkina Faso, and recently Niger. So they're very unstable, but also countries that people perceive as being stable, like Côte d'Ivoire. There's a lot of more sort of covert political violence. You know, if you're not with the kind of the leading ruling party, then severe pressures can be applied to you. So people look at places like Mali and Sudan and see very overt, explosive violence. And you can understand in Sudan, where there's a war, why people need to leave. But there's also other pressures that are more hidden and less well reported. And also a big factor is climate change, you know, mm-hmm. particularly in places like northern Nigeria. The land is practically being burnt. There's no place for farmers to graze their cattle. It's very difficult to grow crops. And we're also seeing that in Tunisia. Normally, you know, in September, you have a glut of tomatoes. Now there's hardly any at all. So those climatic pressures and there's just a simple lack of availability of things to eat are making people think, well, maybe I'm going to try my luck elsewhere. Something that's not well understood. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say, it's really interesting that when we talk about, you know, the impact of climate change. You know, people think, well, you know, you understand why you'd move if it was incredibly hot and, you know, unbearably hot. But actually, the impact on suddenly crops, you know, you don't need very much change in the weather, in the temperature, in the climate to, you know, if crops fail, then suddenly you don't have a business, you don't have anything to eat, you don't have any money. And so you go in search of somewhere else where you might be able to get work.
So initially they migrate to cooler areas of their own country. We've seen in Nigeria conflicts rising because of this. And there comes a point where it's unbearable. And also the impact where you have violent armed groups moving into an area, it might be actually the cooler area where the people come under pressure, where there's more violence and where you have incidences like Boko Haram. One thing that's not well understood is actually how many people die in the desert en route, you know, crossing through Mali and Niger. The death toll there is incredibly high. And then there's also the other thing that's driving it are the traffickers. This is a multi-million dollar business. It is good business, smuggling people across the Sahara, up to Tunis, through Libya. And also in Libya, you have this really infernal system of kidnap and ransom. As soon as people come into contact with traffickers, they can find themselves sort of arrested, inverted commas, and they find themselves held in these really disgusting so-called prisons where the jailers are ringing up their family and pressuring them for money. So there's generally a lot of money to be made out of sub-Saharan people on the move. If they do manage to make it across the sea, it's an incredibly dangerous crossing. We've seen, particularly in Tunisia, a rise of this sort of homemade metal boats that the traffickers are using. They're not single use, they're being repeatedly used. And of course, salt water and steel is not a good mixture. I've spoken to people who've literally watched boats break apart and lose hope. And thankfully, they were saved. So the pressures are huge, and you know, for people who want to try and make a life for themselves and find a, you know, a better future, Europe seems very attractive. But also there's another disconnect, because a lot of the migrants that I've met, and also refugees, are professional people. They're this image of migrants, because they look down at heel, that the image is that they must be uneducated, and that's actually not necessarily true. People are highly skilled. You have car mechanics, you have nurses, people who are qualified degree nurse practitioners, but there's no way for them to convert their degree courses or their experience when they get to Europe. And there's actually a need for professionals and skilled people. So that is not being connected up at all.
There's a lot of dots to join there. Exactly. Elizabeth, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, because we're going to try and get around the world in the next few minutes. Elizabeth Volkman is a journalist in based in Tunisia, covering North Africa and migration. We're back on the plane now. So now we land in the United States. So let's get the picture there when it comes to migration, illegal migration. Caitlin Dormos joins me. Caitlin, if we think that British politics can be obsessed with this issue, I mean, it dominates a lot of the political conversation in America too.
It certainly does. It's one of the highest issues that are facing certainly the Republicans in the Republican nomination for the presidential election next year.
And is that because the problem is getting worse, or is it because politicians, Donald Trump in particular, has sort of put rocket boosters on it, put it up in lights and other mixed metaphors about raising the salience of it as being an issue?
It is really a multi-pronged approach. There is certainly securitization of that topic, of the threats that immigration faces the United States. But what's going on is that we have a crisis at our border. Under Donald Trump, he had issued so many regulations and been so outspoken about not being welcoming to immigrants, especially those from South America and Mexico, that immigration numbers dropped for his years or were relatively low. I'm looking at 2020 right now. 646,000 immigrants came across the southern border. This year, it's been 2.5 million. It's just since.
Is that legal or illegal?
That is illegal crossings.
Wow. So when we hear about 10, 20, 30, 40,000 people arriving by spot, I mean, obviously America is a lot bigger, but in terms of the numbers, is a lot higher. So is it right to say that actually Donald Trump's approach worked? It was very unpopular with the, you know, Democrats and the liberal left in America. But in terms of stopping people entering the US illegally, it worked.
You know, what's funny is it's, you have to separate the dialogue from the actual policies. So Donald Trump put in place a number of anti-immigration policies, including one called Title 42, in which the coronavirus was used as a way to turn back immigrants, illegal immigrants who'd crossed into the country. Joe Biden kept that in place and was in favor of keeping that in place as long as he could, and didn't change a lot of those immigration policies early on in his presidency, and yet the numbers continued to climb. So, you know, we were looking at that 646,000 in 2020. By 2021, it was nearly 2 million. And all of that is basically, there was no change to the policy themselves, but it was a difference in rhetoric. So suddenly we had Biden in power, and Biden is all about creating legal pathways for immigration. And there is this idea out there that, oh, the United States is more welcoming to immigrants now. Whether it's based in policy or not is questionable.
It's really interesting that. And I suppose when it comes to Rishi Sunak's got stop the boats, obviously Donald Trump had build the wall. Did he build the wall? And is it still there?
There's parts of the wall up. There's also lots of building material for the wall that cannot be touched anymore, just lying there. But largely, I mean, the borders remain mostly open. I actually had the chance to go down to Brownsville, Texas, which is right on the U.S.-Mexico border in southeast Texas. And it was stunning because I could see from across the Rio Grande, that's the river border between the U.S. and Mexico, I could see the immigrants across the way, readying for their trip to cross this very dangerous river to come across onto land. And if they could come onto land, there was some barbed wire, but they were laying their blankets over the barbed wire and able to get over that barbed wire pretty easily. And it's just a matter of whether or not there are border guards there to stop them. So, you know, those numbers that I was listing off earlier, those are the numbers of illegal immigrants that have been encountered by Border Patrol. If you can actually get across and not be encountered by Border Patrol, because so much of it is open, you're just in the United States.
That was Katelyn Dornbos from the New York Post, giving us the picture in America. Right, back on the plane one last time. Quite a long way, going around the back, I think, on this one. Heading from America to Australia. Right, here in Britain, we hear a lot about an Australian-style points-based system and the offshore immigration system. It's part of the inspiration for the Rwanda policy and where the Stop the Boats slogan originated. In fact, here is the then Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, making that pledge a decade ago.
And I am never, ever going to apologise for stopping the boats. Our system is too soft. Our system is too soft, and we are in the business of toughening it up.
So let's speak to Samantha Maiden, political editor for news.com.au. Samantha, what is the Australian Stop the Boats policy, and did it work?
It did work for a while, and it was actually first introduced by, I suppose, one of Tony Abbott's political mentors, John Howard, in 2001, so over 20 years ago. Australia first introduced offshore processing in Nauru and PNG under what became known as the Pacific Solution. It all started when a boat arrived. It was actually intercepted by a Norwegian container ship at the MV Tampa that rescued hundreds of asylum seekers that were stranded on an Indonesian fishing boat. They tried to take them to Indonesia. The asylum seekers didn't want to go, and then they wanted to take them to Christmas Island, which is an island off the Australian coast. The first thing that the Conservative government started doing was basically excising parts of Australian islands. So they started carving them out of the immigration zone and basically saying if you turned up there, you wouldn't be admitted. And this all occurred against the backdrop of September 11. And so there was a very kind of nasty debate that started playing into it about whether there were terrorists on these boats. And ultimately they introduced detention was already in place, but they introduced offshore detention, and they used the slogan that predated Stop the Boats, which is "We will decide who comes here and the circumstances in which they come." That was the message that John Howard took to the 2001 election.
I mean, fundamentally, one of the biggest differences between Britain and Australia is the distance that they're coming from France to Britain is just so much shorter.
Yeah, the distance isn't the only thing. I mean, you know, obviously to a scale, but the number of asylum seekers coming was, you know, there was a great deal of moral panic about it at the time, but I don't think there was any comparison between the number of asylum seekers coming to Australia compared to this number of asylum seekers that are in Europe and that are trying to get into Britain. There's always those issues, though, that, you know, plenty of them are flying in by plane as well, and there seems to be this particular obsession with boats. I mean, this has been an issue that's really ripped apart the Labor Party in Australia for decades. They tried to dismantle offshore processing in 2008. And then as boat arrivals started to track up again, which obviously the coalition, the Conservatives would argue would be because they dismantled that the asylum seekers started coming back. Basically, they reintroduced it in 2013 reintroduced it in 2008. And 2012, they reintroduced it. And basically, they went through a similar situation to what Britain has been going through in that they wanted to send people to Malaysia. The High Court said no. Then they had to send them back to Nauru. But, you know, it has been about, at the time, a deterrent and finding somewhere that was just so you know, horrific, basically. People getting Manus Island, and they sent the women and children to Nauru, and they sent the men to Manus, and some of them didn't survive it. I mean, some of them were bashed to death in riots, suicided, people set fire to themselves. Wow. You know, it was a very grim policy.
Yeah, and wowzers. Samantha, really good to speak to you. Samantha Maiden there, political editor for news.com.au. Rounding off our tour of the world. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And get in touch. You can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, from me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.